welcome back to the Debugged Congressional App Challenge podcast. I'm your host, Medha, and today I'm with Christine Rushlow. Christine Rushlow received her bachelor and PhD degrees at the University of Connecticut, then began her postdoc training in developmental biology, first with Dr. David Ish Horwitz at the Imperial Cancer Research Fund in London, and then with Dr. Michael Levine at Columbia University. Since 1991, Christine has been running her own lab, first at the Roche Institute of Molecular Biology, and then at New York University, where she is currently a professor of biology. Her major research interest is the study of how genes control development from a fertilized egg to an adult. She has been an active member of the scientific community for several decades, training future generation scholars through activities such as mentoring students in her lab, including undergraduate and graduate students, as well as high school students, through a STEM summer program for New York City high school underrepresented groups, including Girls in Science. As director of WINS at CAS, Christine emphasizes the importance of research experience as well as networking across disciplines with mentors and peers. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, and thank you for inviting me.
Of course, really happy to have you. And for those who don't know, I'm part of the WINS program, and so I feel very privileged to be talking to you one-on-one as well as being part of the program. And so I really wanted to hear a lot about your research. Why did you get started in your research about embryonic development in the first place?
Well, I started working on the model organism, Drosophila melanogaster, which is the common fruit fly, when I was an undergrad, actually. And this was at the University of Connecticut, and I stayed in that lab for my PhD. And my boss, my mentor, was Arthur Chovnik, and he was a famous geneticist. So he was, well known in the field, and I just had the opportunity to work for him, so I stayed in his lab for my PhD, and I learned a lot of basic genetics. You know, we cross the flies, and then we look at, their offspring. And when I moved from my PhD to my postdoc, I started working on embryos. And that's when, I basically laid the foundation for what I do now. And so, we were asking the questions, which genes are important for development? And at the time when I did my first postdoc, genes were just starting to be cloned and sequenced. And what that means is that the DNA responsible for a particular genetic trait that we knew we had mutations in, they gave phenotypes that affected development, for example, some mutations don't have a head. Another mutant didn't have a tail, the back end. Other ones didn't have abdomens, right? So there were mutations that people made, actually, by mutagenesis and isolated different lines. And, we had a phenotype and the gene was mapped to a chromosome by genetics. But that's all we knew. We didn't know what the gene encoded. And so when I say genes were starting to be cloned and sequenced, that means a particular part of the genome, that sequence of DNA, we had to prove that it was the gene that we had genetically isolated and had mutants for. And so that's a series of molecular biology experiments that you have to do. And so I was involved in doing that for some of the first genes that had been started to be cloned. First in London with David Ish, and then in Mike Levine's lab. And so I was involved in a lot of that early molecular characterization of genes. And they turned out to be really, for biologists out there, transcription factors and all kinds of different types of proteins, signaling molecules that were really important in molecular biology. And then it turned out that some people who worked in mouse labs, they took our genes because we knew the molecular sequence of them, and they looked for similar genes in their organism, like the mouse. And they found there were homologs, meaning very similar genes were present in the mouse. And so this is important because it turned out, people became famous for this, like Mike Levine, because we have the same genes as the fruit fly. Right? And in some cases, the sequence is very closely identical, not 100%, but 80%, sometimes 70 to 80%. And in the protein sequence, it's even higher, more highly conserved. But as it turns out, some of these genes do the exact same thing in the processes of development. So for example, if a particular set of genes was important for subdividing the body into different segments, well, it turned out it did the same thing in the human, right? Those were the homeobox genes. Or if it was important for making a central nervous system, right? So one gene was very important. If you didn't have that gene active, you would not get a CNS, a central nervous system. That's a pretty important gene, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
The same gene does the same thing in humans, right? And so that's the important, and that's the impact that our early work and continued work in the field of development using the model organism, the fruit fly, who would have thought we have the same genes that are important for making our central nervous systems and brains, right? So that's basically the impact of what I do and what embryologists and developmental biologists do when they use model organisms to find out how it works in humans, and hopefully in the long run to be able to understand a pathway of development such that if it's affected in humans, you know, human development, then we can hopefully try to fix that, whatever that, you know, issue or problem or disorder is, by doing molecular biology in the long, you know, and it depends on what the disease is, but maybe finding, you know, drugs that can actually alter the molecular mechanism to either fix it or to change it to become more normal than a disease state.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's incredible. And so what are some like impacts that you think are going to be drawn from this kind of research over the next couple of years, or that you hope could be drawn?
So again, we're, you know, my specific research right now, I told you about what I was doing in the past, but right now I'm interested in the genes that control really early development. And so these genes come on, you know, in the, okay, you're an unfertilized egg, right? And the mother puts a lot of gene products into her eggs so that it can kickstart development of the embryo. Like it can get through the initial divisions to get to more cells. She actually puts in quite a few regulatory molecules to get you started on your pathway to development. And these are very important. And I've worked on those for many years. Some of these, we call them maternal morphogens, that are really key regulatory molecules. But they activate certain genes. And, you know, a lot of key molecules that the mother puts in activates, or are transcription factors that activate the zygotic genes, meaning the embryo's own genes. So the embryo basically have to start making its own gene products, and it has to become independent from its mother, okay, just like in normal in life, right? So you grow, you're an embryo, and then you're, you know, a juvenile, and then you basically are independent of your mother or and your parents to sustain yourself. So I study those really early genes and how they get activated by the maternal key regulator. And this is important because all animals do this, right? So, I mean, people who use the model organism zebrafish, it's a very similar mechanism of how these things get activated. And we think the same kind of mechanisms are going to be, you know, all the way to humans. And so in my lab, we discovered the first, what we call genome activator. So this is the regulator that activates all those really early genes. And then they were found in higher organisms. And so we kind of laid the foundation for that there are regulators that activate these genes.
Wow, that's absolutely incredible. And so thinking about students, like high school students, undergrad students, what is something that you think that what kind of background should they have before, engaging in their own scientific research? Or what is one thing that they should try to learn to help prepare themselves?
So, you know, depending on the field, it is helpful to have some knowledge of whatever they do. Like I study transcription, which is, going from DNA to RNA. And, you know, it's helpful to have like at least intro bio, which also teaches you a little genetics. So I like students to have at least 1 year of bio before they come to my lab. And that's probably true in chemistry and physics and math, other disciplines as well. But, you know, high school students don't always have a lot of biology before they come into my lab, right? So, I mean, it depends on what city they're from. In New York, they take it in their freshman year mostly, but and so they do have it. But, you know, you basically have to teach them a lot while they're in the lab. And that's fine. That's fine, right? So I think it's more important to have the not so much the background in the discipline, but to have an idea of that you have to be really careful when you're in the lab and you have to be focused when you're in the lab. You know, it's more like that aspect of coming into a lab. You have to be prepared to really focus, and you know, to spend some time because experiments take time. To be prepared for experiments not to work, so you're not going to have success, you know, all the time. You know, you learn how to be tenacious and to try to fix and troubleshoot problems. I mean, you have to have, you know, a little bit of an attitude that, oh, I can tinker with this and get it to work. You know, so you know, you have to kind of be prepared to kind of, you know, use your own resources and to get out there and try to, you know, make things happen. And so if you come a little bit prepared that, hey, you know, I'm going to kind of have a little leeway here. I mean, I'm going to follow direction, of course, but, you know, I'm also going to have the opportunity to think about what I'm doing and to fix things if they go wrong, but also if things go right, which hopefully they will, to interpret your findings. Right? And you learn this by from your mentor as well. So, you know, when I have high school students and undergrads in the lab, I kind of teach them the scientific process, right? And so you have to kind of be open to different avenues when you're actually in the lab. You're not just going to be doing one thing the whole time. So, but it's exciting and it's fun. So.
I think that's great advice and honestly applicable for almost any kind of endeavor that you could partake as a student, right? Which is really nice. And you know, as someone who does computer science, I feel like that's also very applicable. Like trying to learn as much as possible as you can before going into a project, but like being prepared to like be disciplined and learn and problem solve and just like know that things aren't going to work the first time you try. And so, you know, bouncing right off of that, what kind of role do you think that technology or even the evolution of computer science itself, has played in molecular research over, your time in working with the field?
So I would say that, you know, for students today, everybody should take a computer science course. And if you're in the biology, for example, department and you're a biology student, you should take a computational course in our department because it'll be right away applicable. So, you know, in different disciplines, like in chemistry, I'm sure they have computational courses too, right? That out of the chem department. So, you know, you'll learn a language, you'll learn how to use software to be able to code like R or MATLAB or Python. So, you know, I think it's important for all students to have at least one course like that as an undergrad. And then because even in my lab, you know, which I wouldn't consider myself a computational lab, you know, we analyze data. And when you analyze a lot of data, you have to be able to write scripts to do statistics or just to collate things. You can do a lot on Excel, but then you're going to have to query the data. And
Yeah,
so
of course.
it's really important. And you know, my students have learned from scratch. I mean, one of my students just learned from a book and then by troubleshooting, you know, and I don't know, I don't have that background, but you know, from what people tell me, you kind of have to learn it on your own anyway, even if you do take a course. You really have to just practice it, right? And so I think it's incredibly important, and it's incredibly important in biology.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, that's really cool to hear, honestly, as someone who's in computer science, the fact that like if you have a background and you have interest in other fields like you have the ability to apply it to like things like biology and like in other sciences as well. And so I wanted to ask a little bit about like the WINS program and what was the intention and inspiration for creating the program, as well as like what kinds of opportunities does it offer to advance the inclusion of women in STEM?
Let me back up. So, we have a lot of mentoring within the program and avenues to take your next step. For example, if you're going to PhD program, if you're going to apply to PhD programs, we have a night where we just talk about the statement of purpose. Okay, so not everybody in WINS is going to apply to a PhD program. We have people in med school, right? That, I mean, want to go to med school. And so, I have somebody from med school admissions come. And they talk to WINS as well as master's students who are interested in undergrads that might want to join can join in too. And that's very valuable because you hear from people in admissions that are doing the admissions, right? So we have events like that. But one of the events that I thought was necessary was our things were it's basically called Career Paths in STEM. And this is to invite women who do let me say this, alternative careers, which, it might not be alternative to some people, but for example, not somebody who is just a PhD who runs a lab like me. Okay, so I've had a variety of people come in and talk, like somebody who does consulting, right? She works for one of the big consulting firms, and it's about science, right? She consults about science. I've had, people come in who were postdocs in physics, right? Not biology, but physics or biophysics. And, I've had people who have come in and talked about jobs in the government, which people were didn't know anything about, including myself. And so she kind of opened up a whole world to us about all the different agencies that I actually hire people in STEM. I'm going to have somebody this semester come and talk to us about big pharma. So she's an industry. And so we haven't had anybody in the past 2.5 years that spoke to us about what it's like to have an industry job. So it's just different types of jobs that you can have and go. And they're all women who have been very successful in those jobs. And we also have panels. And so this is my favorite thing because we invite 3 to 4 professors. And it depends on we change the topic of the panel. So, for example, one of them was about challenges in being in academia, just being a professor. Here, what are your challenges, and specifically as a woman, being a woman and dealing with, your colleagues that might not be politically correct, and dealing with that issue, dealing with, if you have children, how do you juggle being a mother and being a professor? And then there's also the challenge of being invited to committees because you're a woman, and we get over invited so we get overloaded. And then there's all kinds of other issues too. So all these came up, right? And so I think that was incredibly informative. And the professors were at different levels, so we try to also mix the panel, right? So we have somebody who's an assistant professor, somebody who's a full professor and has been for many, many years. And it was really funny just listening to the different types of challenges that they have or had in the past were different because, times have changed, right? And so that was really interesting and eye-opening for everybody, I think. So, we had last semester, we had a panel on that was entitled Conversations in Diversity. And we had a master's student, a black master's student, a Hispanic master's student, a PhD student, another master's student, and then we had a black professor here from our department, Barbara Acomb. And again, it was really interesting to just hear of the, about the challenges in STEM being, a black woman or Hispanic woman, So we try to, have different kinds of events so that as most informative as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like an incredible initiative, and a really valuable opportunity for undergraduate students and graduate students. And so, lastly, I wanted to ask if you had any advice, For younger students, particularly because they middle and high school students primarily listen to this podcast, on like if they're passionate about doing lab science.
Well, you have to reach out to the lab themselves. Okay, so for instance, you know, for undergrads here in the bio department, for example, you know, the director of undergraduate studies has a website that can list like adverts almost for people looking for students, okay? But unfortunately, there's a lot of students. And so, you know, there's not always labs looking for students, although there are sometimes, okay? At the master's level, some, you know, people also don't know how to find students, right? And so they send me ads and then I send them out to students. So you have to look for that. But basically, you have to kind of look around to see whose lab you might be interested in joining and then just send emails. Most of those probably will get no reply whatsoever. But, you know, I think you should keep trying. There are organizations like the one that you mentioned that I'm involved in, which is for New York City students, high school students. That's a program called ARISE. And that's an acronym for something out of Tandon. So Applied Research and Innovative something, STEM and Technology, or something like that. And they, you know, have a program. You have to apply to it. So look around for programs like that. But, you know, a lot of people email me, you know, students. And I, you know, I say, you know, my lab, I take them sometimes because somebody's leaving. I need somebody to come into the lab. Yeah. So it just works out. The timing's good. Other times they will say my lab's full. So, but what I do suggest is not just trying here at NYU, for example, but try the medical schools, because medical schools do not have undergraduate programs. So they don't often have undergrads looking for, I mean, they will take them into the lab, but they don't always have, you know, opportunities to meet undergrads. So, you know, there's a lot of medical schools in New York City, right? And like I said, so some of our undergrads go to those medical schools, especially NYU Med, but there's a lot, Cornell, Sloan, you know, Albert Einstein. I mean, I'm sure Columbia have their own, you know, cohort of undergrads, but there's a lot of places out there that might take you on as an undergrad or even high school student, okay? So you got to put your, you got to put feelers out. You got to be proactive, and you really have to do a lot of work to do that. And if you reach out to somebody, you should say something about, I'm interested in your work on whatever that is that they do. Like, look at their website, even if it's just for 10 minutes or 5 minutes, to, you know, say, I don't, you know, and tell them what experience you do have. If you have, of course, you're going to attach a resume. Everybody in high school makes a resume at some point, right?
So amazing. You know, thank you so much. That's really, really good advice. And I'm sure it will be useful to someone listening. And it definitely was useful for me to hear some of those things reiterated. And so lastly, I wanted to ask if there was anything else you wanted to add before we ended the podcast.
You know, you have to look for scholarships, opportunities, stipends. You know, there's a lot of things out there. For women of color, there are all kinds of summer research internships. We even have one in the biology department. It's not just for women of color, but there's a lot out there, right? So you have to be very proactive about, you know, doing your own research to try to find opportunities. And, you know, eventually your hard work will pay off. And
Medha, I just want to add that I think what you're doing is fantastic, and keep up the good work.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And now I'll pass it over to our next segment.
Hi, I'm Meryl, and welcome to the Tech News Roundup, where we'll brief you on anything and everything that's happened in the world of tech in the past 2 weeks. Well, as expected, there are new updates on the Twitter and Elon Musk saga, and they've completely thrown the business world off the rails. Musk recently announced that he has gathered enough funds to buy the entire company for $46.5 billion, backed by various banks counting on Tesla shares. What this means is that he has enough funds to completely own and manage the company, taking it private. While Twitter's board of directors recently adopted a poison pill policy that would make it difficult for him to increase his shares by that much, Musk could theoretically get around that with enough of an offer. There's a lot of speculation as to why he's made such a dramatic move, many of which have to do with his own vision for the world of social media and online communication as a whole. Whatever it is, any new updates will definitely be reflected on his Twitter account, so keep an eye out. But Twitter itself has certainly not been quiet these last few days. The company will now let its creators be paid in cryptocurrency, part of a larger trend with corporations being more open to the crypto world and willing to let its users take advantage of it. It will use a slightly more stable currency tied to the US dollar to do so. And on Earth Day, Twitter announced that it will be taking more stringent measures on the climate crisis by banning advertisements that contradict the scientific consensus on climate change, to quote the statement. It'll follow UN guidelines to make those decisions on which ads are misinformation. And this comes after Google recently made a similar announcement, and Meta has come under fire for not doing anything to combat misinformation on Facebook. There's really no better gift for the Earth than contributing to its protection. But speaking of misinformation, the EU recently passed a law in an effort to curb disinformation and harmful content, one that specifically targets companies like Amazon, Google, and Meta. The Digital Services Act would require platforms in the EU, like Facebook, Google, and Twitter, to stop the spread of misinformation on their platforms and disclose how their algorithms recommend content to users. It will also prohibit certain types of advertising, such as those directed at children or those corresponding to people's ethnicity or sexual orientation. This comes in companion to the EU's Digital Markets Act, which would try to stop online sellers like Amazon from becoming monopolies. In space news, scientists saw on Saturday a violent stellar explosion that produced the highest energy gamma rays ever observed from a nova around 5,000 light-years away, confirming them as sources of gamma rays. The implications so far for astronomy are unclear, but it's still pretty cool. Now, back to you, Medha.
And that's that. Thanks so much to our tech news expert. And thank you so much to our tech fans and listeners. This has been the Congressional App Challenge Debugged Podcast. Be sure to check us out on all podcast streaming platforms. And if you want to hit up our social medias, check out the Congressional App Challenge on Twitter and Instagram. I'm your host, Medha Gupta, signing off. Thanks for listening. Bye.